from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The people running Atlanta's NBA franchise were certain that this season would be different, that this year the Hawks would not only learn to fly, but soar beyond their sorry recent predecessors right into the NBA postseason. This confidence led Hawks management to offer season ticket holders a partial refund if Atlanta didn't make the playoffs, which it seems it will not, since Atlanta is currently half a dozen games out of the hunt with only 20 games to go. Joining me now on the line is Atlanta Journal-Constitution columnist Jeff Schultz, who's been chronicling the tumbling Hawks. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Glad to be here.
Whose idea was it to offer money back to season ticket holders if the Hawks didn't make the playoffs?
That would be the person who doesn't have a job anymore.
Why am I not surprised?
Although, that would be Coach Lon Kruger, who was fired the day after Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say this, if the Hawks did not make the playoffs this year, Lon Kruger probably would have lost his job anyway, and so I'm sure he just looked at it as a way to get everybody excited, maybe get the team excited, perhaps get the team pumped up into believing that they were a playoff team, which most people probably thought they were before the season,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even as a way to sell some tickets. Really, none of it has materialized, though.
Well, that was going to be my next question. It didn't sell a great many more tickets than they perhaps would have sold. What was the initial fan reaction when the rebate plan was put forward?
You know, I guess the best way to answer that is to kind of tell you about the Atlanta sports market. It's a very much a bandwagon sports town.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of the University of Georgia football team, you pretty much have to win here to get people to show up. So in answer to your question, the Hawks fans did not go crazy when the guarantee came out. I think everybody talked about it, and people were kind of amused by it. But there was not an avalanche of ticket buyers at the box office.
What was the reason that the team was not more successful? As you said, people looking at it dispassionately before the season began thought maybe the Hawks would be a playoff team this year.
It is a team, for whatever reason, is less than the sum of its parts. They have some pretty good players. You know, Glenn Robinson can score. Sharif Abdul-Rahim is a nice player. Theo Ratliff, Jason Terry, Deion Glover, these are nice players. But collectively, they're not very good. They have a lot of weaknesses there. They're not very good defensively, which, of course, alone does not put them an exclusive company in the NBA. But they're not very athletic. There's really not a great floor leader on the team. They don't really have a true point guard either, which is also a major problem. Jason Terry bounces back and forth from point guard and off guard, and consequently they don't have a great ball handler back there, and consequently they commit too many turnovers, and they're not good enough to make mistakes and win.
Pete Babcock, the Hawks general manager, recently said about his own personnel moves, and I'm quoting now, "We've stuck with our plan, and I've been wrong all across the board." Have you ever heard a general manager be quite this honest about what's been going on?
No, but I guess if he had said anything else, anybody would have laughed because, Pete is a great guy. And consequently, it's not like people are out there rooting for him to lose. Fans, media people, everybody likes Pete. But the man must have pictures of somebody at AO all Time Warner to have kept his job this long. Because if you look at every signing and every trade that he's made, on the surface, when the deal has been made, you look at it and say, you know what, that actually wasn't a bad move. But collectively, he hasn't gotten it done.
Mm-hmm.
And when you step back, it never really seems like they've had a big picture plan. It seems like they're constantly trying to add a piece to fill a hole, but there hasn't been a big picture plan where you can say, okay, this is where we want to be in a year. This is the kind of team we want to be. This is the style we want to play. They don't have an identity. They've never really had an identity, not in several years. And I would be stunned at this point if he had a job before next season.
Perhaps the lowest point for the Hawks, and this is a tough one to pick the lowest point.
Fill me in on this one.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe, though, it was the All-Star game. Atlanta hosted All-Star weekend, and yet not a single Hawk player represented the city in any of the events. Couldn't the NBA have found some Hawk, something for some Hawk to do somewhere?
Well, actually, let me correct you slightly there. Jason Terry actually was in a three-on-three game. Although so was Frankie Munoz, the actor. he was in the same game, and just so you know, Frankie Munoz was on Jason Terry's team, and I believe Dominique Wilkins was the third member, and the Hawks again lost to the Lakers in the 3-on-3 game. Mm-hmm. And however, beyond that, it would have been nice because it was a great show here in Atlanta that weekend, other than all the traffic problems, and it certainly was a great marketing opportunity for the Hawks that was wasted in part because they didn't have a player in the game. But you know what? If you have one of the five or six worst records in the league, you don't deserve to have a player in the game.
Well, this has altogether been a fairly gloomy conversation as far as the Atlanta Hawks are concerned. Jeff, let's try and end it on an up note. They're going to be a lottery team if
nobody's
your
dead.
Prediction is right. Right, nobody's dead. And is this the kind of team that can be helped with a great lottery pick? Have we got any hope that they'll be much better next year?
See, now the problem with the Hawks is even in the silver lining, there's some potential gloom. The Hawks made a trade for Glenn Robin. They traded their first round draft pick. Now, there is an asterisk in the trade that if the Hawks have secured one of the top three selections in the draft, one of the top three lottery selections, first, second, or third, they will keep the pick. But if it's not the third, first, second, or third selection, if it's the fourth or below, the pick is lost. Mm. The pick goes to Milwaukee. So potentially, you know, if they're seeded fourth in the lottery, they get nothing.
It leaves very little for me to say except my condolences.
Well, fortunately, I don't have a financial stake in the team. I just write stories. And I'll say this, the Hawks keep providing material for me to write stories.
Jeff Schultz is a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jeff, thank you again. And, hey, at least the Braves' opening day is just around the corner.
That's right.
Considerably more successful than the aforementioned Hawks this winter have been the Indiana Pacers. An honest-to-Isaiah challenger from the East, the Pacers have looked like a team that can't be derailed, except perhaps by their own occasional self-destructive impulses. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor has our story.
If you want to win the NBA title, you have to fail first. The Indiana Pacers are one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference, but if NBA history is any indication, they have a ways to go before they win a championship. For example, it took the Detroit Pistons most of the 80s to figure out a way to get past the Boston Celtics and later defeat the Los Angeles Lakers for their first title in 1989.
I can go back to when I was playing, and we were making our way through the league. I think Milwaukee won the Central with 50 games, and we were behind them with 49, and we had a chance to win the Central in Atlanta, and, you know, we didn't understand the importance.
Isaiah Thomas, a Hall of Famer and heart of those Piston teams, is now the Pacers head coach. He took over in 2000 after the Pacers won the Eastern Conference. However, several trades and retirements changed Thomas's team from one of the league's most talented group of veterans to one of its most talented group of youngsters. The team and its first-time coach had a lot to learn about winning in the NBA.
You know, when you're young and you're growing up in this league and you're trying to carve out some turf, there's some tough lessons that you have to learn, and the only way you learn it is by getting burned by the fire sometime.
Basketball may have been born in Massachusetts, but it was raised in Indiana.
Conseco Fieldhouse's PA announcer may be right in his assessment, but the NBA championship trophy has been in Los Angeles for 3 years. Pacer fans, like this one who attended a recent home game, are hopeful after 2 years of steady improvement, their team can finally change that.
That whole team is just gelling. I mean, the whole team is gelling. They're doing a fantastic job. They got great chances all the way to the big game. I think the only team that's going to get in their way and come right down to it is the Lakers.
The Detroit Pistons and the New Jersey Nets, the defending conference champions, should be added to that list as well. In last year's first-round victory over the Pacers, the Nets barely won a very physical and dramatic Game 5 in double overtime. The tension from that series has spilled into this season. There were three ejections when the two teams met in their first game back in November. But physical play is something Coach Isaiah Thomas learned a lot about when he was point guard Isaiah Thomas for Detroit. The Pistons in the late 80s were nicknamed the Bad Boys. They were one of the toughest, most physical, and some say dirty teams in NBA history. All-Star center Brad Miller says Thomas has instilled some of that style of play in the Pacers.
He's able to definitely give us a lot of, you know, neat little tricks and, you know, ways to play defense, especially, you know, in terms of trying to rotate and, you know, what do you want to do here? How do you want to play us? You know, he's real good at that.
Some NBA observers feel Thomas is also teaching his team how to play dirty. Miller says that's not fair.
Well, you know, people like to just put things together and make stuff up. And since Isaiah and them were called the Bad Boys, you know, some geniuses decided to call us the Bad Boys because we, you know, got a couple of flagrant fouls early in the season. And, you know, people just were afraid to play us because we just played hard.
Unfair or not, the Pacers have been involved in controversy all year. Much of that has surrounded short-tempered swingman Ron Artest. Artest is widely regarded as the best defensive player in the league, but Artest has been suspended three times this season, including one after a confrontation with Miami Heat coach Pat Riley during a game. Thomas has acknowledged that though suspensions and scrutiny have been a distraction, he is pleased with his team's success.
I think it goes back to last year, you know, in terms of making a playoff run and the resiliency that the team and the players showed during that run. And when you're trying to get to the top of the NBA and being the best in the NBA, it's a tough ladder to climb.
The Pacers are climbing that ladder now. And while teams like the Lakers and Nets are wary of playing Indiana in the postseason, it remains to be seen whether or not the Pacers are ready to finally win an NBA championship. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Boston.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In Great Britain, the Flora 1,000-mile challenge is underway, and it will continue to be underway for quite some time. In this marathon of marathons, competitors must cover a mile every hour for 1,000 consecutive hours. If the four men and two women who've signed on for the challenge were to move in a straight line from London, they could end up in Lisbon, Belgrade, or Naples. But in fact, they'll cover the entire 1,000 miles on the course set up for the London Marathon, a stretch they'll know very well indeed by April 13th, when the Flora 1,000-miler concludes, assuming that, having not had an uninterrupted night's sleep in 6 weeks, they'll know anything at all. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the Phillies' quest to return to the National League pennant race. But first, Robert Sorley currently holds the lead in this year's Iditarod race. A nine-way dogfight for second place includes mushing notables Jeff King, Martin Boozer, and Rick Swenson. The 1,200-mile Iditarod requires years of training just to get to the starting line in Nome, Alaska, which one must do before even considering reaching the finish line in Nome, Alaska. One Iditarod hopeful in northern New York has set his sights on a seemingly impossible goal. Despite recent setbacks, he wants to be the first paraplegic musher in the Iditarod. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein has this profile.
When you pull up to Angelo Soriano's home in the northern New York town of Hopkinton, you know you're in the right place. A dozen Siberian huskies prance in chain-link cages in the woods around his home. In a black T-shirt and camouflage overalls, Angelo Soriano guides his wheelchair over packed snow. He lets the dogs out to stretch their legs.
That's my girl. Say hello, Coco Bear. Say hello, Coco Bear.
Coco hops up on his lap and licks his chin.
Hello,
Soriano scans the dog's paws for injuries. Last night, the team made their first 40-mile night run.
Perseus and Nomix are okay after that crazy run yesterday. Coco and Ursa are fine. Dieter's a little sore. He got a little sore on his ankle's a little sore. And Cass, he's real sore.
Checkup's complete. We go inside Suriano's simple one-room house. He leaves the screen door open, despite the 20-degree weather outside.
Kind of climatized, because if you stay in an 80-degree home all day long, and then you want to go outside and it happens to be 20 below, you get colder faster.
Pretty much everything he does these days is geared toward qualifying for the legendary 1,200-mile Iditarod. Suriano is 43, a tough-looking guy with a thick mustache, ponytail, and a muscular upper body. He grew up in a rough Italian neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey. When he was 26, he broke his spine in a car accident and lost control of his body from the waist down. He moved to Hopkinton to live a quiet life, growing vegetables, raising sheep and goats. He got a dog named Ivory and trained her to fetch things for him. One day, he harnessed her up to his wheelchair.
I would keep her out in front of the chair, and she'd keep the line tight, and then I'd help her.
Where was she pulling you, like just on the driveway?
Driveway, sometimes around the field, sometimes out back behind my neighbor's property. After she really showed that she had what it take to be a lead dog, and I put Coco and Pepper behind her, and we started running three dogs, and I said, wow, I can do this, you know, this is really good, and then I just increased from there.
Over a couple years, Ivory had 12 puppies, and suddenly Suriano had a dog team. He bought a sled and harnesses. He started to mush, using his upper body strength to hold himself upright on the sled. Now he's riding the rails every day in the winter. But it's a long shot even for an able-bodied person to finish the Iditarod, or even qualify for it. It's one of the most grueling races on Earth. It's got brutal mountain passes, hundreds of miles of Arctic plains. Suriano says he knows what he's up against.
The real test is when you're, like, out on the Yukon River and the wind's blowing 50 miles an hour and the wind chill's, like, 30 or 40 below. Then you see what you're made of. So that's the real test, and I guess I'm going to find out, you know.
Suriano had set his sights on the 2005 Iditarod, but he hit the first bump in the road a couple weeks ago. In a 60-mile race in Maine, Suriano and his team took a wrong turn and had to scratch. That meant he couldn't enter into a 250-mile Iditarod qualifying race in New Hampshire. To add insult to injury, he came home to find the pipes in his house had burst, coating his living room in ice. And still, the relentlessly positive Suriano wasn't deterred.
You know, if I don't make the 250 this year, then I'll make it next year. If I don't make the Iditarod in 2.5, then I'll go for 2.6 or 2.7.
I ask him why he's doing all this, buying all the dog food and equipment, the travel, going into debt, dealing with the logistics of getting a dozen dogs to a race, despite the odds against him. He looks outside a while, then answers.
Motivating people to pursue their dreams and their goals, regardless of what hand they've been dealt in life.
Suriano admits he has some fears about the Iditarod. His legs are susceptible to frostbite. An angry moose could trample his dogs.
But I'm not really fearful of anything, man, because if I was, I wouldn't be here right now. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, my biggest fear is not living life.
And for Angelo Suriano, living life means qualifying for and completing the Iditarod. For Only a Game, I'm David Summerstein in Hopkinton, New York.
You the Gita boy? He's a good boy. Give me a 5, buddy. Give me a 5. Come on, I know you're sore. Give me a 5.
Photos of Angelo Suriano and his dog team can be found on our website, onlyagame.org.
Come here, Vanna. Come here, Van.
Come on, Vanna. Here are some scores from the most recent girls' high school basketball season. In Washington, D.C., Anacostia High School defeated Cardozo 90-2. In Indiana, Bluffton High School beat Blackhawk Christian 77-17. And in Cincinnati, nearly 20% of this season's 500 girls basketball games ended with the winning team at least 30 points ahead of the losers. These scores have many calling for the merciful institution of a mercy rule at the high school level. Among the advocates is Coach Brent Baskin of Lakeshore Public Academy. His team suffered the season's most notorious loss. In November, Lakeshore, a school with less than 50 high school students, lost to Walkerville High, a team that had won two state championships in the 80s, by 113 points, 115-2. Coach Baskin joins me now from his office in Muskegon, Michigan. Coach, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
What happened in that game?
Well, basically, we were outclassed in that game. We're playing a very, very good team, and We're a school that offers the basketball program, and we just don't have the athletes to compete. They were much better than us, basically.
Why did this game happen? Were there no potential opponents for you less accomplished than Mighty Walkerville High?
Well, Mighty Walkerville High, they done the best they could to not run up the score, believe it or not. And basically, it's a district game, and we're both in Class D, and it's just how the draw ended up.
Did you talk to your players as this game was developing? I mean, it must have been obvious quite early that it was going to be a very, very one-sided game.
We knew pretty much before the game that we were outclassed, but my girls play basketball for the love of the game, and they're not the best athletes in the area, though they give 100% of what they have, and they will never stop. They played the entire game. They would not quit. They do not cry. And before the game, I told them if they score 2 points against this mighty team, we will have won the game. And I meant that.
How were those 2 points scored? I want to know whether it was a 60-foot jump shot or, you know, two from the foul line.
No, it was actually a jump shot by Melissa Hawley from about 13 feet out. And it wasn't like we didn't take no shots. We probably missed 10 or 12 shots, but they weren't playing really tough defense against us, tell you the truth. But they're just superior athletes to us.
What kind of conversation did you have with the winning coach following the game?
Truthfully, I thanked them. And I know that sounds ridiculous, but I knew that they could probably beat us 300 to nothing, and that is no lie. If he would have pressed us the whole game, we never would have got the ball across half court. And they would have been on a layup drill the entire game because we might not ever got the ball inbounds, tell you the truth. Their coach is Steve Kerwin, and he is an excellent, excellent basketball coach. He played all of his players, and he didn't keep his starting five out there the whole game or nothing like that. But it's pretty hard to tell a team not to play basketball, and that's what you're there for.
You're right about that. Now, can a game like that, such a one-sided game, provide a useful lesson either to the team that wins or the team that loses?
Well, I don't think that it actually helped the winning team any, because when you're playing in districts, it's always better to play opponents that challenge you to take you to the next level. For our team, just the opportunity to be there was important to my kids because they might not be the best athletes. They probably could not make any other basketball team in our area. They had the right to be on that court and play the same basketball game that every other athlete in our area got to play. They were actually happy to have the opportunity.
Now, Lakeshore's experience was extreme, but not unique. I've been reading a lot about lopsided basketball games between girls' teams in various states, Indiana, Ohio, California, a while back, among others. Is the state of the sport now such that games like this can't be avoided?
I think the state of the rules need to be changed. It used to be that you would have a 40-point clock. If the team got ahead by 40 points, it was basically considered a mercy rule. They would let the teams keep playing, but the clock would continue to go.
In other words, the game would just get over more quickly so the team ahead wouldn't have enough time to score all those points.
Basically. I think that's a rule that will be looked at in the near future here because of situations like this where had the 40-point clock been involved, it probably would have been 70-something instead of 100-something.
Now, I hesitate to ask, but how did the rest of the season go?
We were 0-17. We didn't beat anybody. Our opponent scored 797 points compared to our 184. We're pretty much outclassed by most of the teams we play, except the kids have an opportunity to learn the game, respect the game, and have an opportunity to play the game. And that's what they feel is so important. In fact, if you check their yearbooks, at the end of the year, the funnest time they had will have been during basketball season.
Brent Baskin coaches the girls' basketball team at Lakeshore Academy in Hart, Michigan. Coach Baskin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
The New York Yankees merged money with diplomacy and more money this winter to land Japanese slugger Hideki Matsui and Cuban pitcher Jose Contreras, but the loudest shot in the free agent wars was fired by Philadelphia, where the Phillies bought American and took home first baseman Jim Thome for $85 million. Their acquisition of third baseman David Bell and pitcher Kevin Millwood cost them $25 million more. In baseball's alleged new era of fiscal austerity, what were the Phillies thinking? Ron Schachter asked that question on a recent trip to spring training in Clearwater, Florida.
As players stop to sign autographs at the Phillies' camp in Clearwater, no one's talking about what went on last spring when all-star third baseman Scott Rowland spurned an almost $100 million contract extension and railed at management and fans in a bizarre keynote speech to yet another losing Phillies season. Catcher Mike Lieberthal has anchored the Phillies lineup for 6 years and has seen the change in team chemistry.
Well, this year there's obviously a lot. Everybody's pretty positive. It's we got three new players. Obviously the situation with Scott Rowland's over, especially last year, the situation where they offered him, you know, a contract and he didn't sign it, and there was always that negative feeling with himself and the club. So it kind of lingered with the club, I think, most of the year. And and this year, obviously, we are better. We're a better team.
After the Phillies finished the 2002 season with an 80-81 record, general manager Ed Wade collected the money Rowland had left on the table. He may have needed a front loader, and tapped into future revenues from a new stadium set to open in 2004. Then he set off on a Steinbrennerian spending spree at a time when most other teams were backing away from long-term contracts and baseball's rising luxury tax.
In 2002, we sort of fell off the baseball map. So we felt that if we were going to get involved in this, we really had to be aggressive. And we were in a position where the timing really worked well for us because there were a lot of teams parked on the sidelines who couldn't participate.
In November, Wade made a substantial offer to Cleveland slugger Jim Thome and didn't let up until Thome had signed a six-year, $85 million contract. The Phillies also gave multi-millions and multi-years to third baseman David Bell. And when their overtures to Atlanta pitcher Tom Glavine fell short, they traded for the Braves' 18-game winner Kevin Millwood and his $10 million salary. But Philadelphians have seen rosters loaded with highly paid athletes fail before. And it's not clear how the soft-spoken Thome, who hit 52 home runs last year but left the rebuilding Indians to join a pennant contender, will respond to the increased fan and media attention in his new home. The challenges of Tomey's transition haven't been lost on Phillies GM Ed Wade.
I think it's off to a tough start in April. We've joked about it. He's had some tough Aprils from time to time, and he'll probably hear a few more boos in Philadelphia than he would in Cleveland going through the same type of thing, but he's prepared for that. Jim did a lot of homework. He talked to Mike Schmidt. He talked to Scott Rowland. He talked to Pete Rose.
Thome also visited the construction site of the Phillies' new stadium. Jim Salisbury has covered the team for 10 years, the last seven of them for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Some electrical workers had 100 hats printed up that said, you know, Philadelphia electricians want Jim Thome. And, you know, he was leaving and they stopped the limo and he gave him a hat. He actually got out and shook their hands. And I know that meant a lot to Jim because, you know, he comes from a blue-collar background. And he has friends that, you know, make their livings that way and probably in unions and whatnot. His father was a union man. He's a real regular guy, and I know that touched him.
Pitcher Kevin Millwood seems ready to make the necessary adjustments as he munched a cheesesteak sandwich in front of his locker before last Saturday's exhibition game against the Braves. He said he can deal with any expectations Philadelphia fans might have.
To be good, you got to be able to take a little bit of criticism. You just got to understand that, if you're not doing the job, then people are going to let you know, If it takes doing a little bit better to get the fans off your back, you're supposed to be doing well anyway.
The Phillies' high-priced newcomers are joining a team with a strong core of mostly homegrown players. Pat Burrell, Bobby Abreu, and Mike Lieberthal among them. And a successful farm system that produced this year's phenom, center fielder Marlon Byrd. And while Millwood is expected to lead the pitching staff, all-star Vicente Padilla and the developing Randy Wolf also have frontline ability. What's more, the Phillies have locked up almost all of their starters to long-term contracts. That's almost $200 million through 2006. But the Phillies know that opening a new stadium next year won't guarantee the fans will keep coming unless they start winning and winning soon. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Clearwater, Florida.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the stories of some major leaguers whose careers you missed if you blinked. But first, our weekly analysis of the sports news, courtesy of Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
And alas, we have to start by discussing a team that didn't lose, perhaps only because it didn't show up to play. What has happened to the end of the St. Bonaventure's basketball season?
Well, the Atlantic 10 Conference has ruled that a player named Jamil Terrell was ineligible and should never have played. The assembled athletic directors forfeited their 6 conference wins, and then the school presidents of the league went a step further and banned St. Bonaventure from the Atlantic 10 tournament. This caused a complete spontaneous wildcat job action among the players who have simply refused to play. The Atlantic 10 is now completely beside itself, which is one Atlantic 10 too many, by the way, and has decided that there will be some penalty levy. There's even talk of dropping St. Bonaventure from the league, which is impractical because you have to drop all their teams. I am of two minds about this. I don't like the fact that players don't play, but at the same time, you put college athletes in a position where all of their hard work and all the diligence that they put into their season is completely obviated by the fact that the grown-ups didn't do their job and didn't vet this player and then threw themselves on the mercy of other grown-ups. They don't have an avenue or a platform from which to say they think they're being badly treated. So they took the only one they had, which is to refuse to be part of the system anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, this is after all the conference that let John Calipari run what was almost literally a whorehouse at UMass while he was the coach there, and never thought about levying the kind of penalties they're gonna levy on St. Bonaventure for not playing. I really don't know how I feel about this, but I'm not as quick to judge the St. Bonaventure players as a lot of people are.
Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Georgia head basketball coach Jim Herrick's son was fired in the wake of accusations that assistant coach Jim Jr. committed academic fraud and paid a player's expenses. Now scrutiny is being directed toward the remaining Herrick, who denies any wrongdoing, sort of, as I understand it.
Give the guy credit. He threw his son overboard. I mean, how much does he want to coach at Georgia? Jim Herrick has left a trail of this from UCLA to the University of Rhode Island. And now to Georgia. You hire him knowing what you're going to get. This is all coming out right before the beginning of the National College Basketball Tournament, which is the big moneymaker in all of college sports. It really has become a matter now of not wanting to see how the sausage gets made. If anybody thinks anything that may or may not have happened at Georgia is the exception and not the rule, they're kidding themselves.
Why do guys who've mucked up programs keep getting hired by other programs? Is he that great a basketball coach, and are there that few other excellent coaches?
He's good enough that college presidents think they can take a chance on the guy. The same thing happened to Jerry Tarkanian. Jerry Tarkanian was a terrific basketball coach. Fresno State, which is now in trouble again because of stuff that happened during the Tarkanian era, had to know what they were getting into with him.
It is conference tournament time, Charlie. Let's talk a little basketball and not only about transgressions. Which of the conference tournaments will you be following this weekend?
None of them. They're useless money-grubbing schemes that have no relevance to the season whatsoever, except you might get another one of the teams from your major conference in there if they happen to win the tournament, so everybody else in the conference makes a lot of money. This is the most useless week of the year, regardless of how good or bad the basketball is. It has no relevance to the big tournament in 2 weeks, and if it was up to me, all conference tournaments would simply go away. That having been said, I will, of course, be following my alma mater in Conference USA.
For a brief time last weekend, Manhattanville guard Tony Smith had company when University of Virginia freshman basketball player Deidre Chapman turned away from the flag during her team's pregame ceremonies. What are the chances this month that we'll see a male basketball player protest a possible war or war?
Slim to none at all. My guess is that if you see any kind of protest during the NCAA tournament, which, by the way, over that month is when the war will probably start. If you see any protests, they will be off the floor or in the stands. And my guess is that CBS, cowardly corporate media outfit that it is, won't show them anyway.
On Wednesday, Lakers guard Kobe Bryant became the youngest player in NBA history to score 10,000 points. Is Kareem's all-time record in jeopardy, Charlie?
It would have to be. Kareem was almost two full years older than Kobe Bryant when Kareem scored his 10,000th point. In case anyone hasn't noticed, the NBA is having a great season, and it's having a great season because it's having great players having great seasons. Kobe Bryant's at the top of the list, Tim Duncan, Tracy McGrady, Kevin Garnett, who is virtually carrying the Minnesota Timberwolves. This is the beginning of what could be a real golden age for this league.
Team Alinghi of Switzerland, that nation long known for its nautical achievements, won the America's Cup last weekend, Charlie, but I gather the next series will not, in fact, be on Lake Geneva.
Yeah, I mean, the only Swiss Navy guy I ever heard of was Captain Von Trapp, and he had to run away from Austria to become it. Yes, they will put the America's Cup up in the Team Alinghi club room where someone will fill it with chocolate, and there will be a little bird that pops out of it and goes cuckoo every half hour. I don't know what they're going to do. They're probably going to use the Mediterranean. This is pretty funny, though, because this is the culture of free agency, of course, coming to the America's Cup, where Team Alinghi virtually bought the New Zealand team.
Absolutely.
That would have competed for New Zealand. Apparently, the Isle of Wight has stepped forward as a possibility, as has a place in Portugal. Personally, if they put it on Lake Geneva, I'd pay to see it.
Iran's national wrestling team will not compete in September's World Freestyle Championships in New York, Charlie. They say they find the required fingerprinting of competitors there, quote, humiliating and insulting. I suppose all this could change in the 6 months or so between now and then, but I also wonder why fingerprinting athletes competing in an international event is entirely necessary, even in this atmosphere.
Well, why the Defense Department is the one making this decision rather than the Justice Department is another question open. The Iranians, you know, are doing this full in the knowledge that what they're keeping their athletes away from is one of the qualifiers for the 2004 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is a stand on principle, I hope they understand the stakes.
Finally, Charlie, it was revealed this week that tennis star Anna Kournikova and NHL All-Star Sergei Fedorov had indeed been married, albeit for a short time. What are the chances that Kournikova will turn out also to have been married to Pavel Bure, Alexei Kovalev, Darius Kasparaitis, Boris Mironov et al.?
What are the odds that I care? I mean, what was the Fedorov-Kournikov nuptials, you know, officiated over by, like, the room service waiter? I mean, when did this happen?
This is the answer I was hoping for.
This is not stuff I care about!
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and marries Wit and Wisdom each week here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Phil.
On this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org.
So what they do, they took the train to the Ukraine, took the plane to Pittsburgh, PA, in the USA.
In baseball, they say of a guy whose major league career was very brief, he had a cup of coffee in the bigs. Rob Trucks, intrigued by what it must have been like for some of those guys, has collected the stories of 18 such unfortunates, or fortunates, depending on your point of view. The title of the book that resulted is, not surprisingly, Cup of Coffee. Rob Trucks joins me now from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Rob, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
When you contacted each of the players whom you interviewed, you must have had to say something like, I want to talk to you because you hardly played in the major leagues at all. Did any of them hang up on you?
No. The standard procedure is you've got 30 to 45 seconds to convince them that you're not a telemarketer. Then about the next minute and a half to 2 minutes, you have to convince them that you're not their friend who's yanking on their leg. And once you get past those 2 or 3 minutes and explain that you really are a writer from New York and you really wanted to come visit them and talk about their brief major league experience, most of these guys were extremely welcoming.
Some readers may be surprised by the politics of who makes it and who doesn't make it. Mike Jurowitz, who played briefly for the Yankees almost 40 years ago, talks about a guy who got a contract and a bonus. Was it because he was dating the scout's daughter? Have I got that right?
That's the story according to Mike, and I've read enough, talked enough, discussed enough that I don't doubt that story at all. You know, rookie league ball is really kind of like a intro to biology class for freshmen in college. It's a weeding out process. The team Mike played on, he said everybody that showed up was a pitcher, and what he couldn't understand is why they had, you know, 25 pitchers on one team, and so it was like, what other positions do you play? But according to Mike, the scout signed his daughter's boyfriend to a professional contract, gave him a nice little bonus, and man bought himself a car, got hitched to the scout's daughter, and never played baseball again.
That's a nice way to put something in the bank, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Even though their major league careers were measured in innings rather than seasons, these guys have highlights. Ray Peters, a pitcher with the Brewers, will never forget one particular minor league at bat.
You know, it's amazing, or it's at least amazing to me, how many of these guys want to talk about their hitting ability.
They're all pitchers.
They're all pitchers. And maybe their ERA is a little bit higher, but yeah, they want to talk about those home runs that they hit with the bases loaded in the bottom of the ninth when the team was out of pinch hitters. One of the wonderful things about being able to conduct these interviews in person and to travel around in the country is you see the eyes of a 50 or 60 year old man literally twinkle. You see the face break into a grin. Joe Stanka with the White Sox was the exact same way. Joe Stanka has a career batting average of .333.
1 for 3, no doubt.
Well, 1 for 3 in the majors. You know,
right.
That's about one hit better than I would have done.
Absolutely. Steve Ratzer, one of the guys you talked to, actually won a major league game, precisely one, for the Expos. But I would guess that what he remembers most clearly about his big league career was the first batter that he faced and how he got conned.
It was one of those things where I saw it coming from a mile away when Steve was telling me the story. It was the last day of the season. Steve actually pitched in October when he got his first start. And it was the last game of the season, the Expos versus the Phillies, and the leadoff batter was Pete Rose. And Steve threw him a slider on the first pitch, got called for a strike, and Pete Rose turned to Steve's catcher, and he said, "That kid's got a heck of a slider." So the catcher called timeout, ran out to the mound, and he said, "Dude, Pete Rose says you have a great slider." So, of course, being young bucks and not having a lot of experience under their belt, they said, "Well, let's throw that thing again," which Pete Rose promptly slapped into left field for, you know, one of his 4,000 hits.
It's interesting you tell stories like this. I gather all these guys really did enjoy talking to you. There was precious little bitterness in all of this interviewing that you did.
It's really amazing how positive the experience seems to have been for these guys. And to a man, they're extremely proud of being able to reach that select company of playing in the major leagues. They, of course, wish that it had been longer. Sean Whiteside, who's the last gentleman in the book, made his debut in 1995, threw his first major league pitch to Ken Griffey Jr. in the Kingdome with men on base. And I tell these guys, I'll be in your house hour and a half. And Sean was very well spoken, and I ended up being in his living room for about 3.5 hours. And when we realized how much time had passed, I have Southern roots. I apologize for things that aren't my fault. And I was like, "Sean, I'm really sorry if I overstayed your welcome. You know, thank you so much for spending this much time." And Sean just looked at me. He said, "No, thank you." He said, "You really don't realize how little I can talk about this." He said, "You know, people would think I'm bragging." And I thought about it. Sean lives in a little town called Haleyville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're at a cocktail party in Haleyville, Alabama, you know, how do you work into conversation that you played Major League Baseball, that you were on the same team with Boomer Wells and Jose Lima, and that you threw your first pitch to Ken Griffey Jr.? So, you know, there is a certain amount of release, I think, for these guys to be able to have someone who is really and truly interested in every single aspect of their lives and what they went through to achieve their goal.
Sean Whiteside, who pitched for the Tigers in 96, is the guy who recalls when he's talking to you, he says of himself, I helped Mr. Eddie Murray get to the 500 club. So there's a certain lovely self-deprecating side to him, I gather.
Oh, he's got a good sense of humor. Sean's ERA for the career is 13.5.
Oops.
And he said, anybody that brings that up, you know, I pitched in two games. I pitched at Seattle, and I faced Ken Griffey Jr., Edgar Martinez, Jay Buhner, and then my second game, I pitched to the Indians, and that was the year that the Indians had Carlos Baerga, Eddie Murray, Dave Winfield, and Jim Tomei.
Yeah.
So, you know, God bless him for being as low as 13.5.
It's interesting to me the way you put this book together. You are the author. You're the guy who wrote it. But really, it looks like it's pretty close to just transcriptions of interviews. Did you kind of decide right up front, I'm just going to present the interviews, transcripts of them as they happened? Or was there any temptation to kind of be more authorly and write the stories, controlling them more yourself?
Well, I have several friends who are, quote, name, unquote, writers. And every single one of them said, you know, if you'd write these up as chapters, then you could probably sell this book to a good publisher and get a lot of attention. And we'll call that the temptation. So, yeah, the thought crossed my mind. But I think what I do well is talk to people. I wanted these guys to be able to tell their own stories. I wanted these guys' personality. I wanted these guys' voice to carry through. Rather than being an author, I kind of see myself as the caretaker of these stories. I think everybody, whether you're a baseball player or a tax attorney, has a story. My job was to facilitate as much as possible these guys being able to tell the story of their major league experience, and I wanted to leave it in their voice as much as possible.
Rob Trux interviewed 18 pitchers who had a cup of coffee in the big leagues. The resulting book, Cup of Coffee, is available from Small Mouth Press. Rob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you very much for having us.
Your breath is sweet, with your eyes I like, two jewels in the sky. Your back is straight, your hair is smooth, on the pillow where you lie. No gratitude or love. Your loyalty is not to me, but to the stars above.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or check out this week's web feature on musher Angelo Suriano, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from author Rob Trux, who waxes anthropomorphic.
I could have been a cocker spaniel on his back on the floor having his belly rubbed. I was, you know, oh yeah, me and Bill Lee, best friends.
Rob, I'm sorry, but Bill Lee, you know, strikes me as kind of a Labrador Retriever kind of guy. And hey, he was in the majors long enough to have several urns of coffee. Had that been his beverage of choice. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.